Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I think it would be taken down and use it evidence.
So this week we're going to make a rare guest appearance. Like, I'm too lazy usually to have any guests on this podcast, but my dad is over from Wales, so I thought I'd get him on the pod and pick his brain. This is the Psycho Vertical podcast, and I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick, and this is my father, Pete Kirkpatrick. And it might seem what's that word when you have the when you get your family involved in everything?
Incest.
No. Not the other one. Like when you get them a job at the BBC. So anyway, but I think my dad's be an interesting person, so I'm going to sort of quiz him about his life and times. Okay. Before we start, I think you should quickly tell that story about the chef.
all my stories are other people's stories, so I'm going to thank George Cole for this. He's an ex-army guy of the old generation.
Yeah.
So George was telling me about this VIP or senior officer who was going around an army base. And the colonel took him to the kitchens, you know, where they make the food. And he said, "Well, I'd like you to introduce you to Corporal Jones. He's the cook." And the VIP said, "Well, colonel, can I just... We're trying to elevate the status of the catering corps. You know, Corporal Jones is not a cook, he's a chef. Corporal Jones, how long have you been a chef?" And Corporal Jones said, "About 30 seconds, sir."
So I guess this podcast could probably last about a week if we start going from the start to the end. But I think maybe we'll just start with who are you? Like, where do you come from? Where were you born?
Police interrogation. I was born part of that 1947 surge of people into the nation. Born in Hull, a very prosperous shipping port, and then that was a long time ago, wasn't it?
So we better point out your dad was in the army.
Dad was in the army, yeah.
So we keep this on the lowdown because he was in the uprising, the Irish, you know, he was over in the... Like, I seem to remember seeing photographs, I don't know if you had them, but there was tanks. There was like the old World War One tanks, and he was in... It was photographs that were his, but they were in Ireland, and it was...
You probably didn't... I think, like many my generation, that you wish you'd asked your dad lots of questions.
So yeah.
He was also in Egypt when they was putting down and all that was going on. But it was
Palestine. He was in Palestine. Yeah. So wasn't he? Through in South Africa.
So like, he's balanced out. His role in those units was chief clerk. So he's probably arranging coffins, ordering them and filling them.
Who was it? There was someone saying about... The colonies. It was something about Ireland, you know, the colonies or something. Maybe it was a bit Alan Partridge or something. But yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Well, we all have these. It's like having a grandfather who's in the Gestapo in these days to have someone who's in the British Army in the 1930s, 1940s.
One of the facts that I tell about my dad, he joined in 1918. You know, can imagine that, 1918.
That was good timing, though.
Yeah. Well, he joined because he went to the defence of his mother, who was being beat up by his father, and then they both turned on him.
Yeah, them were the days.
So he ran off to the Durham Light Infantry, yeah. So different days. In some way, you know, I ran away from Hull to get to the airport at 17. But I wouldn't have been beaten up.
So you was that 1964?
Yeah.
So in 1964, you know, they have this thing that the 60s didn't arrive in Hull till the 90s.
Oh, crikey.
And, but you know, this idea that you decided 1964 you wanted to be a graphic designer, or, you know, you just run off to London, become this, you know, that just didn't happen to...
No, I was in that... the era of the mod and the rocker and long hair and the Beatles. So yeah, that's my memory of that. No career ambitions.
But like how did you do at school?
I don't have no documentation to support this, but I believe there's 42 in our class.
Really? Great baby boomer. Great baby
boomer.
Didn't
have names, we had numbers.
Yeah. What was school like in those days?
I wasn't inspired by it. I wasn't interested in it. But I was a good pupil. Subsequently, yeah, that I had a career in sport and the outdoors. But my school was had a concrete playground. It had no gymnasium. It had no football pitches. It had nothing. So all my sporting and any ability I had came from on scraps of spare ground and things like that. And parks.
Is it still there, the school? Has it been knocked down?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Oh, really?
It's still
there. Wow. Kind of rare.
Southcotes Lane, everybody knows Hull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you grow up in that house, like when I was a kid, we'd go around and see my grandma next to the...
Moved about, in my time, 3 council houses.
Right.
Yeah. Down Preston Road.
Because I always remember in Hull, this must have been a big thing when you were a child.
Yeah.
With the drains.
Well, drains were, like you for the docks. It was a source of... I mean, I was a champion stone thrower.
Yeah.
That's what my... sport. Yeah.
So kids were always drowning, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, I don't remember... Yeah, I remember swimming, but it was more, throwing things in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're still there, because I looked on some... Because basically, for anybody who doesn't know, Hull is completely flat. It's the flattest place you can imagine. And they drained all the land with these big straight rivers that went out into the river Hull, went to River Humber. So it's for right through the city had these straight...
Well, did it? It was a 50-yard stretch, not all water. And in my time, the banks were jungle.
Right.
Where now it's all been cleansed and, you know, there's lawns either side, where then it was just... Yeah, it was just a park.
And I guess Hull was like one of the most bombed cities in the UK. Like, do you remember anything about that or...?
No. It's only when you go back that you kind of...
There's lots of
compared it to other places.
There's lots of car parks in Hull.
Yeah.
So do you have good memories of your childhood, do you think?
Yeah, I had loving parents. I had an invalid dad, a very supportive mother. And being the youngest of about a 10-year gap between my next brother. You know, it's a bit like a only child, which makes you a bit more independent, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, as I say, to escape from Hull was to join the RAF. I didn't want to defend the Empire or anything. I just wanted to get away from Hull.
Yeah. So why? Why didn't you go? Why didn't you... Was it not that... Because it's interesting. So your other brother went off to New Zealand.
Yeah.
And your other brother became basically a sort of scallywag, a pirate, salvaging illegally off submarines and things.
Yeah.
So obviously there was something in your DNA, all three, like the fact that your dad had, you know, gone off adventuring. Did that go into you?
I think we have brothers like that who go into different parts of the world and sending postcards and coming back all brown with stories. You kind of, you know. there's less desire to be a plumber in your local town. Yeah. So it does stir,
Because I would have thought the pot. In those days, was like going in the Merchant Navy, was that a...
I don't know.
And going to sea, because I guess it was a huge...
I think one of the consequences of perhaps not having the best education, partially through my focus, and then how it was then, I always felt I was thick.
Yeah.
So those higher aspirations for things.
Yeah, yeah.
So self-limiting beliefs, really. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's funny. Yeah, because I guess to go in the Merchant Navy, it wasn't just... you had to be quite skilled.
Yeah.
You had to do a lot of... Because a lot of exams in those days were way more tougher than a lot of exams these days, weren't they?
Because they had Trinity College, you know what I mean? Nautical College, I mean, a lot of people used to talk about being a trawler boy.
Yeah.
Like a Jack Hawkins from Treasure Island, but around fish.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was like a...
But they were... Because those trawlers were going up to Greenland. They were...
Oh, yeah.
It was super extreme.
Oh, yeah, super.
I remember meeting somebody who was a climber. He went on the trawlers when he was young.
Yeah.
And he lost like the tops of all the fingers on one hand. And basically, he was just standing there and the cable just went over his hand and chopped his fingers off.
Yeah.
But he just said that was kind of normal.
Oh, yeah, it was death on a stick. I mean, there was lots of tragedies. You know,
ships getting...
And God wars and all like that.
Yeah, ships getting iced up.
Yeah.
And then the rolling over and stuff.
But when you come back as a young man, you have your selection of women. You know,
it was a story that they would... When the ship came in, all the taxes would be lined up for them.
Yeah.
And they would get off and with all their wages and they would go to the baths.
Yeah.
Because they could, the swimming bath, they would, have a bath and they would get the clothes and go out. But by the end of the weekend, they would have spent all their money and then they would have to be there back on a Monday morning, get back on the trawler.
Like Dodge City or Wichita, you know, when the cattle comes in.
Yeah. Because there must have been a lot of money in Hull. I remember even in, the 70s, 80s, was a period where you always felt like there was money because you had quite a lot of industry in Hull. You know, you had Reckitt's and you had all these kind of big, it was an industrial place still, even though all the bottom had fallen out of fishing.
Yeah.
You still, there was some, but now you basically just have the university. That's that's it, you know.
But Hull seems a long way back, you know.
Yeah.
I've got no rubber band.
No.
Back there. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you? What was your experience with actually joining? Were you thinking of the army or the? Did you just?
I don't know. So far ago, there was no conscious thought, and I was the everybody's in a group, and you might call it a gang, but it wasn't a gang, and so me doing that was quite a radical. To break away from that little friendship.
What you're leaving behind.
Bye. Subsequently, two others followed me, but some time later.
How old are you when you left school?
14 and three quarters.
Right. They got them of the days. You can't leave school now till you're at 28, I don't think.
Yeah.
And
I had a couple of go nowhere jobs.
Yeah. Did that make you double down on getting out of Hull, do you think?
Well, they had two jobs. The last one was a screen printer for a grocery firm doing posters in this Dickensian attic where I was given this thing and go up there and make 500 posters. And I used to just look out the window and then go crazy for an hour and come down.
Sounds like your whole career.
But I was really good at using all the inks, creating bruises on my leg, and then I used to hobble in and say, I'm just falling over. And I used to send me home.
You heard that story about Al Rouse?
Yeah.
And he was a teacher, and he went out to the Alps for the winter time,
for
the winter holidays. And the weather was so amazing. He said, I'm not going back. And he rang up the school and said, I'm in the Alps, I've got frostbite. I'm in hospital, I can't come back. And the head teacher was, that's terrible. And he was like, that's amazing. I want to have a teacher. But anyway, so he came back after 2 weeks and he put tissue in his shoe.
Yeah.
So he was like hobbling around. And the best thing was, he got every Thursday afternoon off because he had to go to the hospital. So he'd go off climbing on the Thursday afternoon. So.
Yeah. You got to be a good liar and a good memory. Don't
So what was it, where did you... You know, how did you get on the train and you just go off to some Where do you?
Well, I did a year's apprenticeship in the supply trade, which is a very complex logistics, they call it now. Subsequently, my first post into is a place called 16MU at Stafford, where all the aircraft bits for all the aircraft around the world were stored, and people used to, yeah.
And you chose that job because that's what your dad had done.
I did an intelligence test, and that's the one they offered me.
All right,
you can either not join or this one. Oh, that'll do then. So offer of one, I'll take
it. So you're basically like working in an office, kind of. Well, not an office, but you're just in a.
Yeah. But then.
And what so someone would want like an engine for like a vampire jet, and they would.
Yeah,
would send from
I'd
India.
I'd stamp the form, not move that. So
yeah, you know, but everything there was everything. Nothing was digital.
No. So I was telling Andy, my job. The form used to come in, like from Singapore, and we need a half a wing. I used to read it, write it down on another form, stamp it, and then put it in a box. And there's a story about some VIP at this place coming along. Can you imagine? Yeah. People with a higher rank had a lot of power, you know. People were frightened of them. And this high ranking officer says to this young airman, "So what do you do here?" He says, I take this fucking vouch from this fucking box, stamp it with this fucking stamp, and put it in that fucking box. And he says, "I beg your pardon." He said, "I take this fucking vouch from this fucking stamp, put it in this fucking box." He went, "Oh, very good." Moved on. There was retribution, though, from others. But the life-changing event, I'd got into climbing before that during my apprenticeship.
So you had no experience of climbing the outdoors?
Yeah, when I was in RAF Hereford.
But not before that?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. Oh, they used to come, this gang used to come to the Lake District and camp up Bowness, or beyond Bowness, Barkernock Farm. And we used to explore, but there's more interest in shoplifting and chasing women but I always had the urge to go up, the one above Ambleside, you know, the one, the big ball, what's the damn thing called? yeah, that
one of them ones, one of them green
one
ones.
One of those green ones. So I had the urge to, go up the hills.
Yeah. So you're stamping your forms.
And I joined the RAF Mountain Rescue.
Yeah. And was that, how did you find out about, how did you find out about them?
Don't know. I must have, a bloke called Mike Shannon was a flight attendant or introduced him to climbing. He must have come up with that subsequently.
Yeah. And were you involved in any sport in the RAF? Were you playing sport?
Oh, yeah. I played sport. Rugby was my thing. I was a rugby league, but I converted to rugby union. Yeah, I played all sports.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, because it was a way of passing time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in those days, would someone just come up and say, did you know what the Mountain Rescue, like what they did, or?
No, they had this glamour thing, but they also had a reputation. So for those who don't know, Mountain Rescue had a operational task of rescuing crashed aircraft, which there was a lot. More than you perhaps, but also supporting the civilian team. But they weren't professionals like the part-time firemen. They had a core professionals to look after it, but then all these odd things. And they were just like my brother, pirates. You didn't have to wash, you didn't have to shave. You could wear anything you want, take you away, and at the weekend, run over the hills, drink a lot of beer, come back, occasional rescue. And it was like the Bash Street Kids going away for the weekend.
Yeah, yeah. You were giving free vehicles and...
Yeah, beer was, what was it, 1/6 a pint, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So, but you got exposed to climbing, walking, mountaineering, and I did that for 3 years, and then I got
Can you remember your first rock climb?
It was in Simmons Yard.
Yeah. All right, yeah.
Down the wire. That was in my apprentice thing.
And what would you be wearing on your feet?
I did have a period shortly with Trikunis.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, I think I've seen a photograph somewhere. Yeah,
with
leather boots with metal things and, hammered in,
pieces of string wrapped around your waist.
Yeah, your waistline.
wasn't a waistline, it was just rope.
But just rope tied around like a weight, and then you're tied into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a body belay.
And then I was around where they drilled industrial nuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
No harnesses. Yeah.
They didn't really
body
fall
belays.
Off. Yeah.
We weren't that good enough to fall off of anything steep. No, I never. But we used to practice falling leader.
Yeah.
On little triffin.
Yeah.
Where they tie you to the rock and then they go above you, and with about 50-foot runoff, to a big like tractor tire and let it go.
Yeah.
The tractor tire used to go bouncing down, and you had leather gloves on. And
yeah.
Then people broke legs with that whiplash.
God.
Yeah.
Someone, I think I remember someone telling me about that training where the rope snapped or something, and everyone standing at the bottom, all like laughing at this poor numpty up there, and then the rope snapped, and this big tractor tire was hurtling down.
Yeah.
There's no health and safety, I'm guessing.
Well, it was yeah.
Because I remember you telling me that you went up to Schnecter in the Northern Corries, and you
cut steps.
Yeah, you cut. But what is now the descent path?
That was my first snow and ice climb.
Yeah, all day long, like going steps.
Called Mick Young. Mick Young's out there. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. And we went back to the campsite, and there's two women there, and they thought it was heroes for climbing this big North Face.
And now people are skiing up it, probably, and things, mountain biking up it.
But we thought it was the dog's bollocks.
Yeah. And how? And did you learn from other people? Did you always have someone more experienced?
It was a bit like a public school. You had a party leader. It was a pecking order.
Yeah.
And I was young, I didn't have a beak, so I would just said what I was told.
Do you think those old guys would see something in someone and they'd be like, you know, they're fit, they're keen?
Yeah, there was a... It wasn't my... You know, I was in Martin Rescue, that thing, for about 15 years, and there is a meritocracy where as it got more professional towards the latter end, you had someone on the lowest rank in the Air Force, and he had within his group on the hill, his party, you might call it, like a wing commander.
Yeah.
And the wing commander would do what the young lad told him to do.
Yeah. Oh, cool. I guess it was interesting because you got to see climbing almost like that was kind of the golden. That's kind of Willens and Brown and all that kind of stuff, isn't it? Like they were, were they like heroes to people? Or?
Yeah, I remember stood next to Joe Brown having a piss in the Penygurrid, and I was in awe. I went back and said, "You don't just had a piss next to."
did you have some like real scares when you were climbing early on?
I don't think I was. To climb severe was then quite necky, good protection. So and the consistent thought is never do anything you can't reverse, never fall off.
Yeah.
It wasn't push it. You haven't tried till you've fallen off.
Yeah,
it was the opposite.
And you were saying that traumatic was like the hard man's crack.
Yeah,
where now it's more like the bumbly.
Yeah, I was scared of going. I remember. Mental breakthrough going across Cib Goch. I'd heard about all these things, and it was only till I was on Snowdon, a load of like nuns came by and asked them where they'd been instead of Cib Goch. Something like that.
And did you go on any like foreign trips in the early sort of?
Well, Scotland was foreign then.
Yeah. Did you had the motorway going up? Would you have the A9 and things?
I only went as far as south of Lancaster.
Really?
Yeah.
So it must have been a long old drive.
And the A5. Was it the A5 goes up Scotland?
A9, yeah.
It wasn't like that. It used to go a bit like that. None of the railway go a bit. And it was.
Oh, really?
So it would take 2 days to go up to Abermore.
Yeah. And you were saying about going skiing, and you were just just camping in Glencore.
I was camping at Corlinbridge.
Right. So in the winter,
in a tent, and we had a fire, and my plastic boots melted. I remember that, trying to ski. Yeah. But you talk about health and safety. You could go up there, Climbing and walking and that, and then you could go to the ski place and say, can I stand in for dinner hour and I'll get a lift ticket.
Yeah.
And so I used to do that, so you get free skiing.
All right. The world, because I did this podcast and they're talking about the Falklands War.
Yeah.
And they were saying that would never happen now, that, you know, that it was so by the seat of your pants and, you know, because it's...
Yeah.
Life was cheaper in those days, you think.
I don't know. I mean, luckily I was more in the business of trying to save people than...
Kill people, yeah.
Than kill people. I don't know. We did the best with what we had.
I guess some people were making mountaineering clothing.
Yeah.
Like ventiled smocks and things. But it must have been... Was it cobbled together what you had?
Well, one of my claims to move the system on, that the military is a big organisation and they have, going back to equipment and that, they have scales of equipment where this unit has a scale of equipment, they're only allowed that and you can only demand off that. And our scale of equipment for Mountain Rescue was drawn from the war and they're like gas capes. these big leather gauntlets. There was prehistoric, you know, yeah. There was prehistoric, so we had to, you know, people were buying their own.
Yeah.
Or people were saying, we're going to get that from a local thing, part of the scale, but say to the bloke, if I give you, can you give me that instead of that? So there's a lot of fraud,
yeah.
But benevolent fraud. He was trying to, as a team leader, he was trying to get you guys the best gear because he deserved it. These guys were giving up three weekends out of four of their life.
And what kind of boots did you have? Like the old, like...
Well, actually, used to think called Careless, like a single skin leather boot.
Yeah.
No padding within it, no insulation.
Yeah. And then you started getting proper, like...
And then people used to buy...
Galibier boots or something.
Galibier boots like that.
Yeah, God. So what was the first ever kind of call-out you had where you had to go to a plane crash?
My first call was a vampire. You mentioned Vampire the Vidana. Some of the Bear Winds.
Yeah.
And that was a fatality.
Yeah.
In mist, trying to find it. And so around that time, you learn about these things by others, you know, these elders. And there was a Victor bomber had gone missing or reported missing. We had to go looking for it. And in my young mind, I was looking for, walking through the hills, I was looking for like a badly parked Victor bomber.
You know,
or all the shape of a plane.
Yeah.
Like that. Well, I can't see
like it. Like Flight of the Phoenix or something.
Yeah, like. Just you know, like the Empire State's building. You know, you can't spot it. It didn't crash, it had gone somewhere else. But when you, majority of aircraft that crash, they just splatter everywhere or there's a trail of damage.
Yeah.
This vampire, we found it, or it was found by the team, by tasting the water. And then there was petrol in the water from streams. And we followed the streams up into the mist and
all that. Yeah. Oh, wow. That's an interesting way of doing it.
And the smell of the
like having to deal with sort of dead people, like there's no like training.
No, there was no post-traumatic stress debriefs and that. And that particular one, it was fragmented, so you're carrying around in a plastic bag, you're not collecting the bits.
Yeah. God, yes. Yeah. It's amazing, you know, to think that you know, these days you'd be, you know.
There was that kind of bravado and the humour that kind of sometimes go around it.
Yeah.
But it's only when you...
Is that effective, do you think? That you're all experiencing something horrific.
There's respect for the dead, so it's not disrespectful. At the right time and the right, there was one of the ways of the respect we used. Not spoke we. There's a general, really anger about press photographers trying to capture images like that.
Right.
Real venom against them.
Yeah.
So that shows some empathy for the deceased.
Have you heard that story about when John Harling, when he died on the Eiger and his rope snapped, he fell all the way to the bottom? like when Chris Bonington got to his body at the bottom, yeah. like they said that like someone's fallen, and when he got there, he realized it was John Harlan. He said something like he would have killed anybody, even though he was a photographer.
Yeah,
he would have killed anyone who tried to take that photograph.
Yeah, disrespect.
Yeah, but he said that the photograph would completely encapsulate the horror of mountaineering, but no one could ever take it or something.
Yeah. But I remember seeing a photograph of the deceased with his family in some local newspaper, and that's when this is not just a collection of meat. This is a human being.
Because I guess in the war there was a lot of people who died unnecessarily, weren't they, who crashed on mountains and they were still alive. And they couldn't get couldn't get them down and things. That's why
I've never rescued a pile of plenty of them up, dead ones, but never rescued.
So. So you were just like a part-timer, you're working in the stores, and then you're going out.
Then I went to Leeming one of the storemen on the rescue team, the one in charge of all the red socks and those gas capes and things like that.
Yeah.
That was my empire.
So RAF Leeming, where's that? Near York?
That's near Yorkshire.
Yeah.
And then I took a trade change to this, become a physical training instructor.
So for you to get the job actually in the RAF, they must have seen potential in you. You must have been like mega keen.
What, to be a PTI?
No, to get actually a full time.
Oh
job on the Were you a gear nerd? Do you think? Oh yeah, I didn't follow in your footsteps to be the storeman.
I don't know. When I later was on, the shoe was on the other foot, and I was trying to recruit people. Used to ring round. You got any good lads there? Yeah, this sounds good. So, send him up and have a look at him. It was a bit like a football manager. He was trying to recruit the best people.
So did you have to become a physical training instructor? Was that another?
That was 6 months training. Yeah.
Yeah, and what kind of training does it involve?
You had to cover all the major sports and be fit and. Lots of stuff.
Was that the fittest you've ever been, do you think?
No. That was pretty fit.
Is all that kind of like stuff on like wooden horses and jumping over bars?
Yeah,
and
gymnastics where I couldn't do, and fencing and other things like that, which I was useless at. Yeah.
And there's lots of ironing involved, or is less ironing?
PTIs used to wear vests. There was no shirt, no tie. Just like a
white vest.
Yeah, so there was actually less ironing. Yeah.
All right.
There wasn't much bullshit in that. But one of the things you had to take, call it Swedish PT. Can you imagine 40 people all lined up and you get them all lined off in lines and all going, feet together, jump! Round my body twice. You had to put on a bit of a show sometimes.
Because you never struck me as someone who would be shouting at people, getting them to do. You know, you're not like the.
Someone said you shout, but you got a twinkle in your eye.
You don't mean it. I think you remember telling me that. You just had plimsolls. There was no like.
Yeah.
There was no like running shoes.
5 mile run, white plimsolls.
Yeah. and I guess like there was no.
That was
like
the climbing shoe as well.
Yeah. And there was no like nutritional stuff, would be.
Egg and chips. You know,
Because there was a podcast someone saying about being a pro wrestler.
Yeah.
Like in the, you know, back in the day. And how it was frowned on to drink water. So people would be training like all evening with no water. And they thought it would toughen you up, you know, so. But now you'd be running with your camelback on in Europe.
We definitely were at the cutting edge of sports science.
But I guess like, you know, Roger Bannister and all those kind of people, if you look at their... Although someone said that Roger Bannister's shoes are lighter than most shoes you can get now.
Really?
They were like a single piece of leather.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So...
So
you went on... Did you stay in the Mount Rescue or were you being a PTI...
So I then became a PTI, and then I eventually got myself back to Mountain Rescue as a volunteer again.
Yeah.
But after about a year of that, I was now married.
Yeah.
And then I was whisked off to Sardinia for and then a couple of other places. And then my life changed about 6 years later, where they was looking for somebody for a joint services post at Tawin, which was
in Mid-Wales.
The army outward bound place.
Yeah.
And they couldn't find anybody.
Yeah.
Then somebody put two and two together, because I'm more like hell.
Yeah.
To one of my bosses about, I want to do this, and I'm not.
And how would you find out about a job like that?
No, I was just approached.
All right.
I didn't know about it.
So it's basically walking, climbing.
As a
full time
PTI, I used to take.
It was like the perfect job for you.
Yeah, I took people away to the hills and things like that.
Yeah.
So people knew I was interested.
Yeah. Because that's probably one of my earliest memories of you, is you getting up, must have been 5 years old, like you getting up, which seemed in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And you would like march them all down in the, get them all swimming in the sea.
Yeah.
You know, early in the dark or something. And
put them off for life and me as well.
And what was what? So if you had a recruit turn up, you know, from the army or whatever, how long would they be at that base?
Well, they did a 2 week, was it a 3 week basic outward bound course? Yeah, they'll call that physical stuff, and people getting together to learn as a team and running around the hills. And the staff of that centre were all people plucked from the army. They weren't professionals in the sense, like a PTI. It wasn't their trade. So you had this great range of skills and abilities, but, you know, great character as well.
Yeah.
And a boss who, if anybody broke a leg, he'd say, well, you can't make an omelette without broken legs. So it was professional, but very much very adventurous.
Yeah. Those things would change, I guess.
Yeah, learn through your mistakes, and hopefully you don't repeat them.
Yeah. I always remember there was, it's not there anymore. Last time I went there, it had been knocked down. I remember there was like a big blocky tower that people must have been abseiling off or something. And, it must have been amazing to have to be paid.
Because
you didn't really have you probably had Reinhold Messner or whatever, or some mountain guides, but in the UK to be being paid to go climbing and walking, it was quite rare, wasn't it?
And the role models were people like Percy Brennan, was just starting at Glenmore Lodge.
Yeah.
And then certifications started coming in, MLC and all like that.
Yeah. I think quite a lot of those mountain training places, national mountain training places, they were often run by a lot of these people who had come out of the army. Like John Barry was a Marine and stuff, wasn't he? So by now you started going on trips abroad, I guess.
Yeah, we went to climb Mount Robson.
Yeah.
which failed.
Yeah. what was the story about Mount Robson? There was some story that some people go up when they didn't come down, or...
Oh, Tim wanted to do... couldn't get up the normal way because of the snow conditions, and there's a ridge like that, and they went up and they didn't come back down, so I went to raise the alarm, and they did find them. They got back to the hut, and they was in a mood with me for the rest of the time because they'd gone for help for them.
And he went out to Yosemite?
Oh, that was... From Tawin, I went to. I did attachment with the Italian army for three weeks.
All right. What was that like?
That was introducing some Mont Blanc and all like that. And Dolomites. Yeah. So
was that a culture shock or?
Well, they weren't as cutting edge the Alpini as I thought. So a lot of drinking red wine while climbing. But it was exposure to that bigger mountain range,
It's funny when you're in the Alps and you see all, and on the Italian side mainly, where you see all the soldiers coming down with all their white, you know, plastic boots and the big rucksacks on. Yeah. It always looks, you know, I guess you're born, you must have to be pretty good at skiing anyway to do that. So you moved over to Lanroost.
Yeah. And I did go on, I, I've heard you say in the past, you know, I went on to go and do a trip, to go and climb something or to ski something or to sail something. They call it an expedition, like you say. It's just another word for holiday, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I went on 28 of those holidays.
Right.
That was outside the UK.
Yeah.
So that was my... yeah, learning curve and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were a store aware on a couple, well, one of them.
Oh, yeah, one, yeah, to the Pyrenees, yeah. But I do remember that. I remember you, it must have been five, that you went, you'd been somewhere where you told a story about being in, maybe you'd been to America or maybe that's when you went to Canada or somewhere, and there was a bear or something. And in my head, it was, you were in a teepee, you know, because it was American Indians, it was a bear or something.
Well, the bear story is it was in Canada, there's a military training place. This is somebody else's story, not mine, I wasn't there. Lots of big plane, all these tents there, and the cooks were the Gurkhas. So
yeah.
Cooking was there. And the dancing was like, there's a bear! And all the Brits are like, ah, there's a bear! And this bear went into the field kitchen, the tent, and the Gurkha rather running away, run towards it, and then there's a big like cartoon, kind of your pans going everywhere. Then the bear comes running out.
Don't mess with the Gurkhas.
Yeah, good old Gurkhas. Yeah.
Anyway, you went to Yosemite for the first time.
I went to Yosemite, three times on different trips. Yeah.
Yeah, and what was and you climbed because you're one of these people where, you know, you're. You know, I must have been to Yosemite like 10 times. And you're like, oh, I once climbed, Half Dome.
Yeah, it was my best climb there.
And what was that like?
Well, Bernie Woodward, another name drop, great guy, better climber than me, great partner. We had a great trip up, but it was... You collect war stories.
Yeah.
I try and make them as factual and not embellished as possible. But this one may seem it can't really have happened like that.
Yeah.
So we start, we kind of walk in, slept below the route the night before, and then do the first pitches. But we couldn't get to the intended bivouac. You got a bit lost. So we're not on a hanging bivouac, we're on this small ledge. So Bernie says to me, I need a crap. What's he have to do with me? But I said, I've just had a crap, but I'm sure I've done three turns, but I've only two plops. Because he had the old paper bag instead of the like sleeping bag, which is half on this ledge. He said, will you look if there was this one of these fuck off conversations.
Yeah.
And then at that point, there's a earth tremor.
All right.
I won't say it was an earthquake, but it was pretty severe. And there's all rocks coming down. And we're like hanging bilay, like pegs like that. Fucking hell.
Where was the spare
tire? No, we had the earthquake. Then he said, I need a shit.
Yeah.
This is proper natural, isn't it? And then he convinces me, my head up, pivoting round, my head inside this sleeping bag, trying to look at this mystery turd when the aftershock comes. So we're just in hysterical laughter at we survived that night. And then we start going up and we bump into the back end of a Swiss guy and a German guy, and they'd linked up by the postcard on the campsite.
Yeah,
climber wanted to do this.
Yeah,
I think the Swiss guy just lost it completely.
Yeah,
he couldn't climb; he was just frozen.
Yeah,
so ended up with Bernie, the better climber, leading this rope of four. And I was at the back, climbing, carrying all the gear.
So you weren't hauling haul bags or anything?
No, just on my back.
Yeah.
And that thank God ledge thing.
Yeah.
This kind of freaked out guy who was in front of me.
Yeah.
He took out all the gear. He'd left no protection.
Oh, really?
So this monster swing. Yeah. And I was still at one end going, fucking hell, fucking. And Bernie was the other end going, what the fuck are we to do with it? Oh, so I, when I eventually got there, he said, "You make sounds like a man about to die."
Yeah. It's really bad enough if you got the gear in, yeah. God. And did you do like Leaning Tower, or did you do what, some other West Face or something?
I'm not really good with names, but we did some bits. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It must be hard, like, to come back if you're doing those, because you are like, you are in this kind of system, aren't you, in the military?
Yeah.
Did you ever just, I guess you wouldn't in those days be like, "I'm just going to, you know, sack it in and I'm going to,"
I was living, so the work centre was Lanroost.
Yeah.
And I used to introduce people to climbing, walk and all that. And then we used to finish work and then I used to go running the hills I had a perfect job. I would have paid to have done that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did that for 6 years, though.
Yeah, God, it must have been amazing.
That's when I was very fit.
Then. Yeah.
And I did the 14 peaks in 6.5 hours.
Oh, wow. And better tell that story about the Snowdon bike race.
Oh, well, yeah.
Because people want to know that exists now. It's like gone in the...
Well, Mountain Rescue had this thing called Snowdon Bike Race where you had a bike and you had to take it around the Snowdon Horseshoe.
Yeah.
Three of you. But the bike had to ride over the start line, then be disassembled into the frame and two wheels, and then carried on your back around the thing. And I'm not sure I'm still the record holder, 1 hour 43, the three of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that thing, the fastest descent of Triffin? Have you ever seen that race people do?
I believe it's something like...
It's crazy.
10 minutes.
Yeah, right? But the guy broke both his wrists.
Did he?
Yeah, we just kept on. He fell down, I think, then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of your... This is another great example of the way you just have these weird stories. Was once I brought up about the Fastnet race, where all these people died in this big storm, and then you were like, "Oh, I was in that."
I washed overboard on that, yeah.
So tell a story about that.
Well, it was the storm which, and I was.
Did it kill like six people or more? It was.
Yeah, and we was like running. One of the experiences I did was an introduction to offshore sailing.
Yeah.
One of these big, rich man sailing yachts.
Yeah.
5 man and all that. And we ran before this storm to try and get away from it, and ended up at Newport Cowes, and there was that many people trying to run away. There was no room in the harbour, so all the boats were like stacked outside, and we was the end boat. So in the middle of the night, it was going up and down. Obviously, I sensed movement, and the movement had severed the ropes, our ropes, tying it to the other boats. So I went on deck, and as our boat was departing the other one, I just grabbed hold of it and ended up in the middle of the night in this storm in the water.
Thank God. Lucky in many aspects not to get crushed or drowned.
Yeah,
or...
well, John Bull, he noticed I'd gone and went up, and he managed to get me out.
All right, God.
One of my 9 lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you were in Lanroost, you weren't in the Mountain Rescue anymore. You were just...
No. But I led immunity. I got myself a bad name for raising some things, and they got moved me out in a week.
Oh, really? And what were you raising? What were you being trouble about?
I just thought some things can be better, and I thought I'd raise it diplomatically. But when you challenge those above you in the military, you're treading on dangerous ground.
Yeah.
And I thought I was...
You're more equals, but you weren't.
Yeah.
You're still in that hierarchy.
I thought I was better than I perhaps was.
I suppose by this time, it's the time of, like, sticky rubber, gear was improving.
Yeah, better gear.
Willens harnesses.
I'd done my MSc by then, where I worked, so you had Plasty Brennan, we had almost the same number of MRCs as Plasty Brennan.
Right.
So there's lots of good.
Because probably that was probably the beginning of when climbing started really becoming it was becoming less of a niche thing, I guess, wasn't it? It was just before you started getting like fear rays and people wearing lycra, and it became like more rock and roll.
What one of my opinions is that it then become a trade, it then become a career,
yeah.
And people were attracted to it for other reasons than a desire to go in the hills.
Yeah,
it was even better than what they were doing, but they didn't have that. They didn't have that passion. They didn't have the desire, and you could really see that. There was capable and proficient, but there wasn't that.
Do you mean like people who are professionals? Like, as in, you know, you're working in an outdoor centre. You're not working there because you love climbing.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's actually unachievable. Everybody's got that.
Yeah,
desire.
Where before you get the impression, you know, when they brought in the system where,
a bit like teaching, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, you know, you get the impression there was a lot of kind of crazy fly by the seat of the pants.
Oh yeah,
instructors, yeah. But they were actually very good, but they had no qualifications, and then they brought in the system where,
yeah,
you know,
qualified.
We're going to You have to be qualified to do this, and then
it weeded out the characters as well. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Because there must be lots of dangerous people around.
Yeah. Yeah. So I suppose overall.
I guess they still are. Okay. Yes. But they are the qualified.
Yeah.
So then you went back into the mountain rescue, did you?
Well, I did a year at the places there's PTI doing sports.
So what was that like, to go back to being a PTI? Was that your punishment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. That must have been that. I
always give my best to a job, so I did the best for what I did, but I was just pining for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're in a flat. Were you outside London or somewhere? It was very flat.
Bracknell, yeah.
Bracknell, yeah. Yeah. God. Your penance for causing trouble.
So then I'd been on.
Did you climb at all then? Were you able to get away and do
anything? I used to take expeditions to North Wales and things like the Lake District.
Right.
Take small groups.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think part of my pleasure, I enjoy teaching.
Yeah.
I enjoy teaching people skills.
Because I've met people who said, oh, your dad took me out climbing in the rain and things. Like, you know, like they'd never been climbing in their life, and he said he took me out, you know, and it was raining and we went and did this ridge or something. And it has this, like, I think you do have a very profound impact on lots of people. Like, I would say hundreds and hundreds of people. Like, whenever I'm touring in the theatres, almost every time someone comes up and says, oh, I used to know your dad or something, you know.
That's nice to hear. I don't know, you catch the, is it a virus? You catch things off different people, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And if I've infected some people,
what happened? Yeah. I guess maybe it's that thing of not taking it so seriously, or having fun, you know, you're having.
People's always said, well, we'll have fun with you.
Yeah. So you did your year as a PTI, as penance, and then what happened then?
I'd been on a team leader's course to be a RAF team leader, because of my previous experience. And then I got a team leader's job at RAF. Leaming, but it was located at RAF Linton and News then, because of a runway maintenance.
Right.
And
what was that like, being in charge of all these people?
I always remember, so like the first weekend was at Grasmere, and somebody came up to ask me a question, and then I like looked round to say, well, what should we do? And there was nobody else there. It was me. I had to go and answer that. I remember that. Oh, I've got to answer that. It was great. It was great, because we had this, you could pick your own, you create your own football team of these crazy people who were giving so much.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Did you, do you know this thing about Cantona? It's Thingy Rodman, but you can only have one Cantona in the team.
Yeah.
Did you have people like that in your team who were?
Oh yeah, I would say 50% were like that.
Yeah.
So you talk about man management. You learn how to manage people and in different ways. The total learning curve. What I was able to bring, because I had this, I'd experienced this professionalism of you know, things like pacing and micro navigation, all these different knots and rescue techniques.
Yeah,
mountain rescue then was mostly blind to that. They just had enthusiasts.
Yeah,
who follow a straight bearer until they bump into something. You know?
Yeah.
So I was able to bring all that. And like anything, if you...
To make it more professional.
Yeah, if you're showing people how to do something easier, you know, there's an appetite for that.
Yeah.
Didn't have to sell it.
Yeah.
So I felt that was able to raise the, you know, some of those standards.
Yeah. And how would, like, civilian mountain rescue teams view the RAF? Mountain rescue teams.
My experience going off, because a lot to do with Langdale Ambleside, depends on the personnel in that. Some were very, very keen. A bloke called Brian Morgan was very, very keen. Yeah, really good relationships, because we was kind of a bunch of people who could fly in and...
You'd have helicopters and stuff.
Well, yeah, and yeah, because mountain rescue then... Yeah, they're generally undermanned, you know.
Yeah.
Resource, you know.
Yeah. I guess it's interesting to look at the history of both civilian... Because in a way, there's less of a call for the RAF to do anything. Because the civilian teams have expanded, haven't they? And
And we're definitely fitter, younger.
Yeah.
Because most of the people were old and beards, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah. All the young people can't be asked.
Yeah.
And I guess it's the type, is it? It's a type of person who's in the mountain rescue.
In the RAF?
Well, in civilian mountain rescue teams.
Oh, all good people.
Oh, no, I'm not saying there's a negative, but there's a type of person who's willing to get up at like 2 in the morning and go looking for somebody.
Yeah.
And it's not a normal person. But it's a type of person who actually, although they might say it's a bit the same way, exactly the same with like the lifeboat.
Yeah.
People, they might complain. Well, they fucking love it.
Oh, they love it.
You know.
That's
one thing maybe about the professionalisation of civilian teams.
Yeah.
In that, you know, if they were fully funded and they had professional, almost like mountain guides, you wouldn't have the same people doing it.
And it's not just, you know, the people at the... I learned it's not just the people at the sharp end, you know, climbing, the, you know, rescuing.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm here to rescue you. It's all the way back. It's the guy, you know, like making the tea or making the soup and come back.
Yeah.
It's the people making sure that the vehicles are okay. Then when you look in a box, something's there around.
Yeah.
It's a whole chain of little things that make it possible.
That the Land Rover switches on when you...
Yeah.
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 Yeah. No, I think it's... I think we do take him for granted, mountain rescue teams.
Yeah.
And I think all of us, so me and my dad were on the hill today, and just my dad got talking to the guy in the little booth where there was a guy giving advice about going on the hill, and he was, you know, he was in the mountain rescue.
Yeah.
And I think all of us, like I've always tried to do as much as I could for mountain rescue teams. Yeah. A lot of them, not been rescued yet. But I think people do take them for granted. You know, they'll give money to some causes, but I think some teams that really struggle with money, where other ones are
super rich.
Yeah. Could buy their own helicopters and things, I guess.
So, you know, I went on a 10-year run of being a team leader in different teams in North Wales, twice, and then Scotland. Yeah.
And did you have many on either end? Did you have people? Did you have trouble with people who you're in charge of? Did you have to get rid of people?
Very rarely.
Were people not suitable, or
so I'm looking. I'm searching for the word. So some of the people that would say, "I don't think it's working."
Yeah.
Where. People who couldn't do 2 weekends out of 4, and they were the married people.
Yeah.
so I'm sorry, you're not putting enough weekends in. So these are married, they're trying to hold the marriage together.
Yeah, yeah.
And because they weren't given half their free time to run rescue, got rid of them. So that's, when I look back, we expected so much from these people.
And so above you, did you have many problems with...
Well... in my era, there were 6 teams then, and 1 squadron leader at the top in MOD.
Yeah.
So we could get away with murder.
Yeah.
I had my own train set. I could do my own thing. Where then it expanded, they had loads.
Share the story about the Land Rover story.
Oh
no, wait,
I'll consult my lawyer about that.
You can't tell that story.
No, I will. I'll tell. there's a rescue, and I asked a guy who didn't have a driving license and can drive a motorbike to drive a very valuable V8 Land Rover up this forest track. We're going to pick up something. I'm not going to mention his name. I said, be careful. And he went around the corner. He hadn't been careful. He was sat by the side of the road and the Land Rover wasn't there. Looked over the side, it had gone down, rolled over a few times. It was on the lower. Oh, God. And that was my last week there in this thing. So they got the incident done. I was speaking to the police inspector in a Scottish village. I said, oh, God, I'm really in the shit, you know. Got this, damaged this vehicle that the guy didn't have a licence, and oh, God, you know. And he said, oh, no worries, right? And he got an old Imperial typewriter, but like a witness statement. Hey, Inspector McLeod was following Flight Sergeant Kirkpatrick at 5 miles an hour when the truck subsided.
Yeah. So you survived.
I have a friend who, I'm talking about mountain rescue in Scotland rather than, I can't say, in the Lake District. There was an affinity between the police, the rescuers. There was kind of like a bond where they used to help each other. And the police did a great job in a place like Fort William.
And
the Scottish teams, in that terrain and in the nature of the hours, they're amazing people.
Yeah, well, you went around, the Great Storm when they had that huge, where the it was like 200-mile-an-hour winds in the Cairngorms. What was that?
That was on Paul Rogers, an RF military guy, got down.
Was that? Were you up there then, or were you down in Wales?
No, I was involved in. There was a storm went through that accession of. A rescue on the a non-rescue on the Saturday somewhere near south of Scotland, I can't remember where, then driving home to Lucas on the Sunday night, a rescue on the Buckle, night rescue, then coming down, slept in the King's House, and then there was a rescue the next day for some missing people who were rescued, people who didn't know the need rescuing, but we rescued people who did need rescuing, who didn't know they needed rescuing.
All right.
So then there was a letter for a missing Boy Scout on Ben Nevis. So it was then from that. So the next day, looking for this, and then the next night, that night, and then the next day. So that was.
So everyone had thought this Boy Scout had died.
Yeah,
but you believed he was still alive, didn't you?
Well, I thought it was my motivation, because I compared him to you.
Yeah, he was a similar age. And probably similarly stupid to me.
Similarly stupid. So I thought, would I give up on my son?
Yeah.
I
wouldn't. And what happened?
Well,
because people have told me that you were like, you were not a man possessed, but you just kept going out, and people had like horrendous blisters and. But people just kept getting people, look, we have to keep going out looking for this lad.
So, I mean, it wasn't just me looking. There was the Glencore team, the Fort William team, RF Kinloss, and I was at Lucas then, and the helicopter, but the weather conditions didn't allow a helicopter search. So we had to sweep search the area to the right of the Red Burn, going up to coming down or up the Ben, rocky boulder from the top field, and I was in the top search party, and it was that misty was searching by altimeters, where you had five in a group and would have altimeter, then a separation of a certain thing, and just following that, and I was at the top, and I found him within 50 yards,
Oh wow.
Yeah,
and he was nearly dead.
Unconscious, nearly dead, and things like that. Yeah.
And what was the story with the helicopter? That's a cool.
Oh, this is, this is another one of the things I can't believe that. and I can't believe it as well. So we found him. We didn't take a stretcher because we thought he was dead.
You know, yeah.
We're looking for a dead body.
Yeah.
But he was alive, just not conscious, but making sounds. So the helicopter was in the halfway locking down there, and Bill Campbell was the pilot. I said, we've got him. So the message came, we've got him. He had this category thing, his Cat 3, you know, he's still alive. And you could hear people reacting on the radio and this kind of, this, it was almost this, all the effort over those 3 days, 2.5 days to find him. It was like a goodwill was flooding up the mountain.
Yeah.
So this guy, there's about 15 of us or something like that. So we'll have to physically put him on our shoulders and carry him.
Yeah.
That was plan A.
Yeah.
And plan B was, so I spoke to Bill. I said, well, if you hover up and I'll call you to me by your noise. You know,
yeah.
There's nothing on this slope that will hurt the helicopter, yeah. I believe.
Yeah. So they could see like 10 metres or something.
Sorry?
They'd be able to see like 10 metres, the helicopter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, the pilot sat on the right-hand side. With the wind conditions, he'd have to be on the outside, and the winchman would have to, in the doorway, going, Dad, I'd have to be watching the wing tips.
Yeah.
Going near the slope, and he'd be giving them instructions. So it wasn't me going left a bit right.
Yeah, yeah.
So he said, that's what we'll do.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah, yeah. And this was like one of the. Would this be like a Sea King or something? A Whirlwind.
Yeah, Wessex.
Wessex, yeah, the old Wessex. Yeah.
So it's quite small.
Yeah.
A crew of 4 people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the man, and he survived.
Well, so Bill started bringing it up, and then suddenly the mist broke.
Yeah.
And so he looked down from the top of the bend there. We can see you. And he goes, we can see you. And they said, well, do a quick strop, which, you know, the wire comes down, you know, like a big loop, which is called a strop. So that's what said. It's a bit like a racing turn. Like, did a racing turn coming around the glen like that. And the strop came down. And whoosh, there was a way, then the mist come around.
Oh, wow, wow.
And was on like that.
God, amazing, yeah.
Yeah,
God, it must be good. It must be a weird job in that your job is actually to pick up on pretty much crashed planes, but then you know.
I haven't saved many. You've saved a few, but I've carried more. You know, closure for lots of people. You know, finding bodies. Yeah, difference.
Yeah. So you must have some funny heli. Do you have any good helicopter stories about going in these old? You know, because the first helicopters used to be going in with the old Whirlwinds and the.
Oh, well, they're just that affinity between the MR trips and the pilots, because you need to have that. The funny stories, like being somewhere, then you say, oh, so we ring up a yellow cab, ring one up and say, oh, we're on so and so, can you give us a lift? Yeah, we'll be round in a minute. Being dropped off in my own back garden once in Langley.
Did you not tell me the ones that you could see that in the old West, the Whirlwind helicopters, you could see the feet of the pilot?
Oh, yeah, you can see the feet moving like hell.
Yeah. Because it's so dangerous. People must not realise how dangerous it is to fly in the
downturns,
in the mountain. You know.
And jumping out of helicopters when the hover jumps. So they're hovering on Cairn Last. Remember Cairn Last?
Yeah.
So we're doing something on the main wall there. So it's hovering like that. And you have to jump out the helicopter onto one of these ledges.
Really? God.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess.
But then, I mean, subsequently, night vision goggles came in, so we still.
Because they were crashes, they had crashes, didn't they? There was. Remember that helicopter in.
Sea King, like on Ben Moore, yeah.
First
fatality, a policeman died.
Yeah. So it's a dangerous. Yeah, because you don't. People don't. Maybe they do realise, but when you call out people to come and rescue you, they are putting themselves in a lot of danger, aren't they?
One of my. Yeah, I went to a rescue on Brown Cove, is it Brown Cove on Helvellyn?
Yeah.
and one of the civilians asked the guy to pass him his ice six, which he did. Unfortunately, he hit him right between the eyes.
Really?
So I had to carry him off. Was that green on? Was it green on green?
Blue or something?
Green on green.
Yeah. God. So you kind of your last posting as a team leader was
a valley,
Arif Valley,
North Wales.
Yeah. And did you want to finish? Would you kept on doing it forever? Do you think?
I would have kept on doing it forever. I was, yeah. My second wife.
Yeah.
allow me to do that, you know.
Yeah.
But a great sacrifice for all the wives as well.
Oh yeah, to be away every weekend and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what? How did it come to an end? Your mountain days, because I should say that, but you were climbing. Like I remember coming out with you when you were doing E3s and
occasionally,
you know. Yeah. But you were climbing well. You know, you weren't sort of.
But I, as a team leader, you weren't there for your own. I always felt that I'd give more to helping others than, I got more pleasure out of helping others, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yes, how did it come
I'm not
to
trying
end?
To make myself as, you know.
No.
But I was a selfish bastard. You know,
yeah. Yeah. How did it end, the RAF Mount Rescue days?
Well, then I'd been 10 years away from my main job, which the RAF had recruited, you know, to be a PTI.
Yeah.
And they had a place in North Wales where they used to train young airmen.
Yeah.
And all the train. Is that the right word?
Like personal development kind of thing.
Yeah, courage, teamwork.
Yeah.
All that communication, gobshite stuff. Which on paper is so dry.
Was the kind of corporatization, like the language changing in the RAF by then?
Yeah.
It was even more political.
Yeah. And thank goodness that, you know, people realised the value of Outward Bound. It always been like in the military.
Yeah.
But then trying to codify it and civilise it and kind of that had my
purpose. Actually before we should do a, because not wanting to be too woke here.
Yeah.
But it was very masculine. It was a lot all men going doing these things, and you were someone who. You were ahead of your time. You were woke before it was a thing, you know, by bringing women into Mount Rescue.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I can't explain that, but I was the first one to bring a woman in. Yeah.
Yeah, and did you have to find a woman, or did a woman want to join?
No.
Yeah, and so tell us a story about the having to come and be checked out. Remember the?
Are they heavy, don't you?
Yeah.
David Wally, somebody from the MOD in charge of Women's Royal Air Force, used to call it then, came up to a weekend to check if she would let her girls come into the mountain rescue system.
Yeah.
And the mountain rescue system then was very, I'll be a polite word.
Like if you burnt the breakfast, you were like staked out and covered in slops and things.
It's quite a robust thing.
Yeah.
And lots of drinking, but lots of effort. You know, good people just having fun. And And judgment, I won't let my girls in with those animals.
But you were saying to me that although she might not be as, on average, as strong as the strongest people, that the female members of the team, they brought things. Like,
Subsequently, in the civilian world, I worked with some top quality young women who were just superb technically, physically. Yeah, so in my mind, there's no offsetting strengths to cover a weakness. They were just great people.
And I guess it shows the kind of someone who'd be willing to, the mettle of someone who's, I'm going to go and join that, go get in the Mount Rescue team or something. It's like really, really cool.
Yeah.
So your days are ended and you got sent off to Bournemouth.
I got like a press gang to be a chief instructor of a personal development place.
Yeah.
Which the style was, you know, I show at you up that mountain and then I tell you what's wrong with you and then you tell how good I am and then we I dress better than you, eat better than you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're nobody, you won't get in my Air Force.
Yeah.
Past my standard.
And was it really regimented when you went?
Yeah.
Because I've been there doing some work, like talking there, and I remember having been to like RAF Mount Rescue, yeah. Like the what would you call it? Like they have a house, you know, like yeah. a building.
Yeah.
And it was always very like, it's kind of like a club, really, like a climbing club. You yeah. know, there's lots of pictures and climbing gear yeah, everywhere. Yeah. Where yeah. I went there and it's really formal and.
Yeah.
You know, like yeah. yeah, like things printed out everywhere, like how not to slip yeah. on the tile floor and everything.
yeah.
So you must have been a shock to them, or.
So I went through a grieving period after leaving Mount Rescue.
Yeah.
To be exposed to this.
Yeah.
And going on the hill with the instructors and seeing how they treat people.
Yeah.
And being told, you know, we don't get too close to them. We keep a distance from them.
Yeah.
We only call them by their surnames.
Yeah.
and so I had my own experience of MR. So MR is a bit like a family
yeah.
in a way. Yeah, even though you've got a pecking order, it's definitely like a family. But I didn't have any authority to say, well, no, that's all wrong. You should do it like this. Let's do it like you do in MR.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about the whole of the...
The whole military was like that.
The military like that. You're questioning military discipline, you know, yeah. military ethos. So somehow I ended up at Braithey Hall, which is a training centre in the Lake District.
Yeah.
It trains young people. And at the time, that was the Plessy Brennan of that type of thing.
Yeah.
Worldwide.
Yeah.
And I was just in awe of how they treated young people,
yeah.
and how they brought the best out of young people, which was, you know, to create relationships,
yeah,
that was better than them, yeah, you know, just be, yeah, yeah,
yeah,
and lots of little subtle things.
You had that story about where you had this thing where you had to jump into this pool of water. And someone asked, remember that story?
No,
you had to jump down into this huge big chasm. And you had to hit like a tree branch, and if you didn't,
oh,
you were
yeah.
gonna.
Yeah.
And then someone asked you if was it being risk assessed or something, and yeah. you'd never heard that before. You know, you realised that the RAF was changing, the military was changing.
Yeah, we used to do some, down slate mines with no torches and things like that. You used
yeah.
to do lots of adventure stuff,
which yeah.
In a supportive, yeah, yeah, but
because the military went like really. Into that, like I've done.
Well, they did have people killed. Maybe that's <they didn't> have...
But even like there was a.
But not in my watch.
I met like a few. Like not someone said they did some speaking event, and someone was saying now they'd literally just come back from Afghanistan.
Yeah.
No, they come back from Baghdad, and they've been full on fighting
yeah.
for their lives.
Yeah.
And decided to do like an orienteering weekend
yeah.
to try and decompress yeah. all these soldiers. But they were like, oh, you can't. You haven't done like a risk assessment of, you know,
yeah.
slips and trips in
yeah.
the woods.
Yeah, I, it's easy to, oh, that was a victim. There's some good come out of it, but it was, yeah, that. So I, to kind of go back a bit, so I, there was a staff of about eight, and we did all, you know, I somehow this eight people, they bought into this new way.
Yeah,
and they went up to Braithey Hall as well and had a taste, and the bosses above us bought into it as well.
Yeah,
so we were this group of people able to change how the Air Force operated
in that one place,
and then subsequently other places as well.
But
was it crumble?
Did you not say that it was this? But as soon as you left, someone came in and he made it all back to how it was.
Well, somebody tried to come back and change it all back to the way it was, and I said, oh. I'm leaving the Air Force because of that. And I
yeah.
got a job at this Braithey Hall. Yeah.
yeah. So that must have been to leave. So how long had you been in the Air Force for?
34 years.
Yeah, God, it must have felt... It's kind of a lifetime, isn't it?
Yeah, but I said to you, I was never really in the Air Force. yeah. I was just climbing and walking and
yeah.
going around the hills.
But you did... It was... You just... Although you had a few, like... you know, not really rough patches, but you did have, like, the dream career, really.
I you've read something I wrote for the RAF Marine Rescue, that 14-year-old lad, you know, leaving school. Yeah, I would never imagine some of the experiences I had. Just amazed.
He went off to the Himalayas. He went to climb all over the place
from Flat Hull.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess you'd think that was kind of the end of your story, like leaving the RAF, because that is a lot of people when they're in the military when they leave, they just get a normal, you know, they don't generally retire. They start doing start working in a FE college or something.
Yeah,
but that is their. That is my son's home from work, and I'm just doing a podcast.
Hi, Ewan.
So, but for you, it wasn't really. It led on to us. It was in a way. It was your life post that has been very maybe richer in some, but different ways.
I always felt that Martin Rescue was an amazing thing, but let's say you saved everybody who died in the hills during the UK at that time. I think the annual death rate was it about 35, something like that?
Yeah.
It's not a lot of people, really, is it?
Yeah.
Not many.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I got involved subsequently in people who were struggling in life, delinquents, crime, drugs, something like that, and they're in the thousands.
So with Braithwaite, you were dealing with young people.
Young people. I got involved with a thing called Youth at Risks. I was a what's that thing that was making me laugh? A management consultant.
Because what was interesting so by the time you left the RAF, I was a grown up, and you went through this weird phase. Well, towards the end of the RAF, when you were working this management, you know, consultant management training in the RAF, you suddenly started reading all these books, you know, and we'd go for a walk, and you'd be talking about things which they're very. You know, when people do like sort of management training or they do like business, they're all reading exactly the same books and they're all saying exactly the same things. Yeah. And you went through a phase where you became what you thought you had to be because that was the theory.
Yeah.
But eventually you seemed to just get rid of all the theory and just go back to what you knew from your.
I thought it was important. I mean, they were paying, they were billing me something like £1,500 a day.
Yeah. That'd be like a month's wages.
Yeah, the bloke was thick. He doesn't feel as though it's worth that.
Yeah, yeah.
And to try and bring that value to
Did you change the way you talk and everything, do you think?
I did. I found I was more effective. What Braithwaite allowed to me to be is be me.
Yeah, yeah.
To be anybody else, and I say that to young people. Once you start learning to like yourself and then being you, then you're kind of a extra level of happiness that you might not have trying to be somebody else.
Have you ever thought about writing? I always say like it's no good having you on the podcast, you can't remember it. You can't remember anything. We've done quite well so far, so
yeah.
But it's such a different. Is it different or is it the same? Is it still working with people?
When did I go to Braithwaite? I went to Braithwaite in 1998.
Yeah,
I left there in 2002 and then I became an associate working there.
Yeah.
But then I worked with in India with street children there and Oman, people from all various things. And now I work with military people who are suffering from post-traumatic stress and other things. Looping it back to the Martin Rescue, there is something so rewarding about helping somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't help everybody, you can't save everybody, but there is something that is worth more than a big flashy car. And I'm hooked on that.
Because now you work for Samaritans as well.
Yeah.
So you're giving up all this free, giving all your free time when you could be.
I am hooked on that, but I also feel guilty that you're getting some pleasure out of somebody's shitty times.
is it pleasure or is it? Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess you've always been busy. That's the.
Well, yeah, yeah.
The only black mark in your book is that you've played golf. That's the.
I know.
You know, yeah. That's the only thing that spoils the.
I do wear climbing gear though when I'm playing.
You're a bit like the sort of the Dalai Lama of Mount Rescue or something, maybe. I don't know.
And I take satisfaction from seeing you do, you know, similar things.
Yeah.
In different ways. Yeah.
No, it's amazing, isn't it? Like the journey of your life, like all the, you know, the. I think we were talking about the path, you know, the paths.
Yeah.
Path divides, you know, splits. Yeah. Like, which way do you go? You might take the wrong path, but you might end. Then you'll end up at another split, which takes you to the right path. And
yeah, I think I come from a what was the word they say? A generation where your mother. So you know,
yeah,
there are casualties sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't have it all sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes that.
You're not. I think I've said to you, you don't feel like your it's penance, like helping all these people.
Probably is.
Yeah.
Feeling I've messed your life up in some respect.
No, I think I told you that you don't have to do penance. Like it's not. We all make. It's not. Well, they're not. Mistake is not the right word. It's just something that.
Yeah.
You know, you trip over something. It's not. It's not a mistake. It's just things that.
You're a different person you are at 21 than you are at.
You don't set out to do these things.
No, you're doing the best you think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how old are you now? I don't actually know. So
74.
Yeah, it's amazing, and you're still out. Still, it was funny today when we were hiking up this hill.
Yeah.
And you were like, "You're not doing this. You're not going at this pace all the time," you know. And I was like, "I'm sure even if we did, it'd be totally fine."
Yeah, I mean, I'm touch wood. I'm lucky. Yeah, my legs still move.
Yeah,
I'm deaf, but
yeah, you're very deaf. Yeah. so this morning I had to go and get my dad up early in the morning to go off walking, and I went in with a cup of tea, and I was like, Dad, and he was, and there was no movement. It was completely dark, and I was like, Dad, and then no movement. I was like. Fuck, he's died. It's fucking typical. He's come over here. He's gonna.
Got cramp now.
Like, typical. I've not seen him for ages. He comes to my house and he dies.
Folks, I had my earphones.
He had his earphones and listened to his podcast. But that terrible thing, there wasn't the feeling of like, oh no, my dad's dead. He was like, fucking typical.
Bother, all this shit.
Yeah, I've got to sort out a funeral now.
Give me a hassle
live. Get his body back across on the. Did you hear this story in Ireland where some people took their granddad
to the betting shop?
Yeah, to get the money out. No, he was out at the post office. He died.
Oh, post office, yeah.
Yeah, tried to get his money out. So, yeah. So I don't know if you got any money. Yeah. I could go to find your credit card or something. Yeah. Well, we've been talking for. I've been talking for a while. So anyway, it's been great talking to you. And have you have any words of wisdom before we?
Well, this offer to do this came pretty suddenly, and no words of wisdom. I'm not wise enough to give any.
I think it's you know, I always start this thing when I do like. Slideshows for, you know, businesses. Yeah. I always say this story about doing this talk at this this thing with all these fighter pilots, these like tornado pilots. And afterwards, I said to one of them, like, "Oh, hope I make enough connections between what I do and what you do." And he was like, "Oh, we're very intelligent people. We make our own connections." So I think you said a lot of things in there that are really, really great. So
can I slide in an Irish thing that someone told me, like a farewell greeting? May you wake up on the right side of the sod. That's to the old people out there.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of good Irishisms, yeah. Okay, so until next time, thanks for talking, Dad. And
I'll see you.
Time for bed.
Time for bed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.